brought my big book so that if I go blank, I can read to you. I, too, am glad to be here. I want to thank the committee that asked me to come. It's been a long time since I've been here. I think it was the first one they had here. And then years later, came back again. And I've always liked being here. And like some of you, the people that are here, you are my family. The closeness, and I'm glad you're crazy, because if you hadn't been, I wouldn't have fitted. I mean, I love that word. I really like for you to use it, Jim, because it fits. And if I couldn't get sober and have fun and be sort of crazy with it, I don't think I would have been attracted to you all. And I don't think I would have stayed. It's strange what does attract us sometimes. So I want to thank you. And Jim, I did hide in my room this morning. I slept all the morning. I want to apologize for it, but God, I needed it. It felt so good. And I appreciate you all just letting me sleep. I'm glad you didn't bother me. I really appreciate it. And I thank you for it. I am Dot Mooney, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And through my alcoholism, I became addicted to drugs. Drugs were not popular at the time I became addicted to them. It was about one of the worst things you could talk about, hear about, or have anything to do with. It was not drug abuse and all those fancy words they've got for it now, Jim. It was dope fiend. And, you know, my drugs didn't come off the street, but my stomach and my mind don't know the difference, whether it was alcohol or drugs or what. And I know now it was through my hangovers. I remember the first drugs I took. And my hangovers were so bad, and I took drugs to try to function during the day until I could get back to my drinking at night, and that was my routine pattern. And I'm going to tell a little about what I was like and what happened and what it's like, too. And I feel the need to go through some of my story of years ago, because I haven't talked right recently, and when I find myself getting away from that desperation, I know I need to get back into it a little bit and share it with somebody. And I grew up in a home that I don't know whether it was normal or not, because I don't know what a normal home is. There was no alcoholism that I'm sure of in my family, but I have learned that there was a lot of strange behavior in my family. It might have been better if they could blame it on the alcohol. But I know now that it was strange. I didn't know then it was strange. I had a good home. I had a secure home. It was a home that there was no outward affection shown in that home, and we were not people to express our love and appreciation for each other, but I knew it. I never doubted my love, that people loved me in that home, and I never, I felt secure in that home. I grew up in the church. My mother's always bragged about that's the first place she took us, and I think I was about 3 weeks old. I'm sure I got a lot out of it, but I went. And it did my mother a world of good that she took me when I was week old, and if she could have taken me sooner, she would have, because it did her a lot of good to do that. And I've always had that feeling of living up to somebody else's expectations. And then eventually, I thought it was other people's expectations, and it was my expectations of myself. I've expected an awful lot of myself, far more than I'm capable of putting out sometimes. And it nearly killed me. I had to drink a lot and take a lot of drugs to do the things that I expected of me until I got where I couldn't do it any longer. I had a lot of fear, I know now. I would like to say this before I get too far into it. I had a terrible fear of God. And I think that was one of my handicaps in getting into this program. I don't know what you all have here. This is Episcopal, I think. I grew up in the, we down there, we call it the, I've always called it the hard shell primitive Baptist church. But I found out since then that it's not hard shell, it's hard shall. They're hard on the shells. I didn't know that, but they say that's really true. Whether it is or not, I don't know. Doesn't make a lot of difference to me. All that's not really important anymore, except that I did have a lot of fear of God. And, you know, that was hard for me to overcome. They introduce my mother right now when they introduce her as a God-fearing woman. And that's a great compliment, I think. I just don't want to be introduced as God-fearing. I would rather it be God-loving woman. And maybe you can fear and love too, but I had such a fear of God that when I got to the program, I was not about to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Him, because I wouldn't do that with anything I was that afraid of. And through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to have that fear changed into a better understanding so that I got the love of God through you people. And I'd always heard that God worked through people, and I didn't understand it until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get in a lot of trouble as growing up as a teenager. I conformed, and I did well, and I was appreciated in my home. I took over an awful lot of responsibility because I was the oldest daughter. I do remember that I had a hard time with my mother. I don't think that's too unusual, but I just didn't like her that much after I got to be a teenager. I didn't like the way she treated my daddy. And I loved my daddy. And I remember one time I went out on the front porch and told my daddy that I could not stand to live in the same house with her any longer and that I was going to leave. And my daddy was a smart man. And he just sat in that rocker and rocked her. And he said, "Honey, I understand what you're saying because I can't hardly live with her myself." And I knew there was no way I was going off and leave my daddy there with that woman by himself. So I stayed there and with my daddy and to take care of him until I was had finished high school. And I went in nurse's training, and I did not complete my... I had to leave home because I couldn't stand it. I was there about a year and got homesick and went home. Now, that tells you the whole story right there. But I was not home long when I was offered a job to work in the hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. It was during World War II, and there was a shortage of nurses, and I went to work there and did the things that nurses do, and I loved it. I loved my nursing. I know I quit because of my insecurity and immaturity, but I love nursing, and I was a good nurse. I should have finished my training, and I used to worry about that a lot, but I don't worry about that anymore, because if I had finished my training, my life wouldn't have ended up like it did, and I probably wouldn't have ended up here with you, and I would never have been as happy a person as I am now. So I am grateful that I went just like I did. I wouldn't change anything in my life now if I could, because it's turned out too good for me to wish I could change any of it. I worked for 6 years in this hospital. I supported myself. I was close to my home. I had a good time. And during World War II, a lot of people had a hard time, but I was a teenager or either 20, early 20s, and drinking by now. I started drinking when I was working there. And I always said, I'm free, white, and 21. I can do what I please. And you better believe I did it. And I suffered the consequences. I began drinking after I had been there about, I don't remember whether it was 6 months or a year, about probably a year. And until that time, I had been able, I can pinpoint my getting away from my principles and church and everything that I had been brought up with from the day I started drinking. It took me about 10 years sober to pinpoint that. And I drank, and I was more comfortable after I started drinking. I was more comfortable without God than I was with Him. And that was, that's just the story of it. That's the way it went. I felt guilty. I felt I didn't belong in the church. I didn't start going. I never did join the church. I've held on to the seat for dear life. They used to get up there and scare the holy hell out of me. And everybody in my family would get up and join the church, and I'd sit there and hold on that chair. I'd lock my arms around it because I knew I wasn't ready to join that church, and I wasn't going to lie about it. I held on to that chair with all I had. I was going to have all the fun I wanted to and do all the living I wanted to, and then I'd join the church when I got too old to do anything else. That was my opinion. That was how I felt about church. And I quit going to church. I was a person that had a lot of fun. I'm not one that never had any fun until they started drinking. I was one that knew you could have fun without drinking. I had grown up and had a world of fun. I grew up in the country. And I feel like people who have never lived in the country and had an opportunity to be a part of country life is underprivileged. And I tell them that, you know, they can't help it. Like New York, I don't know where you are from New York, but if I lived in New York, all I think about when I hear about New York is New York City. And I think, God, those people are underprivileged. But I went through the New York country this recently, going up to the International in Canada. It's beautiful. I don't say that anymore, because it's a beautiful country. Loved it, every bit of it. But I've just had that feeling that it's so great to be a part of the country. I'm a country gal. And some of my fondest memories were out singing creeks and branches with my brother. That was the fun I had. I had a brother 2 years older than I. And he wanted to sing the branches, and I was included in everything they did. Whatever those boys did, I did. And we had boys. That's why I love men. God, I love men. I hope they don't do away with them or treat them bad or anything. I really hope they be kind to men because I grew up with them. I love them. And I just really, I don't have any problem with women, but I just love men. I appreciate them. I really appreciate men. I just like them, like they are. I don't want to change all that. But I think it's because I did have an older brother that I loved, and I was a part of his friends and everything they did. We rode horses on weekends. We had saddle horses, and we'd ride horses the whole weekend. My daddy planted a lot of watermelons, and a lot of people, don't know what it is. I used to go in the fields, and back then there weren't tractors. We had mules, big lot full of mules, and my daddy would plow watermelons. You know, and you'd have to turn them with a stick over one way. He'd plow down that side, and then you'd turn them over the other way, and you'd plow down that side. And some of my fondest memories following my daddy down that watermelon rows. Me and my daddy right by ourselves sometimes, and I loved it. And he grew a lot of watermelons, and a lot of, back then you couldn't sell them. I remember my daddy had loads of watermelons. Now, this is the truth. That he'd load up trucks, they'd haul them off, or they'd just leave them in the fields, a lot of people don't understand the fun you have, but we had a little thing back there that a lot of people don't know about, and I like to tell about it because a lot of people never heard about it. Most people think to enjoy watermelons, you've got to cool them, but unless you have been to a good watermelon roast, you've missed it. And people say, what in the hell are you talking about? Watermelon roast, okay? You know, we had a big farm and plenty of space. And what you do, you get a good crowd of people. You know, like I've always wished that people have a good watermelon roast. I think it would. I just don't think there's any way to beat it. But what you do is you go out before dark and get good coals, charcoal, or we used oak and all that stuff. Get you a good bed of coals, just like you're going to barbecue pork. And you put those watermelons on there, and you get the whole crowd. Everybody gets real enthusiastic over this. And you get those watermelons, and you roll them, and you turn them when the coals are just warm, just right. And they lay on there, and you turn them. And then after it's dark, you have to have a special spot for this. Those watermelons get hot, and they blow up, and everybody goes out in the woods and gets a little piece. I've always felt like... I'm just kind of looking forward to that good old A.A. watermelon roast, you know. Doesn't it sound good? And you know, a lot of people have been motivated to get sober just because they might get to go to a watermelon roast sometime. But I had a lot of fond memories of my growing up days. It was good. I had a good time. But after I went to work, I supported myself, and I was independent, and I liked that. And I thought I was mature. I thought just because I could get up and go to work every day that I was responsible and mature. It never occurred to me that I wasn't. And a lot of times we think that's what responsible and maturity is. And I learned later that that wasn't it at all. I enjoyed my work. I loved my nursing. One of the things that happened there is I was taking my inventory. I went back to and realized in that hospital, after I began drinking, I never went back with my crowd that I grew up with. That's interesting to me, too. I was in my hometown where I grew up. All my friends, my lifelong friends were. And when I started drinking, I never went back to those friends until after I got sober. And that tells me a whole lot there. One time we had a patient in the hospital, and this is a symptom of alcoholism, but I didn't know it at the time. I went out with a group of people, and it was during World War II. And, you know, they shipped everybody off in World War II, any of you here that remember it. And there were just very few men left at home. And suddenly they sent a bunch of soldiers in there. Now you talk about a little country town going crazy. And I just went, I loved it. That was the happiest days of my life till I found AA, I guess. I knew all the girls in town. I knew all the ones that drank. And all I had to do was call and get 10 to 12, 15 girls. And 10 to 12, 15 boys showed up. I don't know how I met them, but showed up. They brought the liquor and the food, and I always had the girls. We just had a party every night. It was party time, and I loved it. One night, I found myself out with a group of people. There was about six of us, and I used to say they ran out of liquor, but I think we ran out of liquor. It was more like it. And I knew we had a patient in the hospital. He had been in a wreck, and I know now he was an alcoholic, and he kept liquor in his dresser drawer all the time. And it was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and we ran out of liquor, and they were out looking at the bootleggers for liquor, and I had heard my mother talk about the bootleggers. And I knew that that was against my principles, even drunk. It was bad news at my house, bootleggers. So I told the fellas, I said, if you'll take me to the hospital, I'll get you some liquor. So they took me. Now, here I am, nursing in the hospital. I hadn't been taught not to do this. I really didn't think there's anything wrong with it. If you're drunk, anything you do most is all right. I found myself doing things that there ain't no way on God's earth I could have done it sober. No wonder I had to drink. So they took me to the hospital, to the back door, and I know now I was drunk. I didn't know then I was. I thought it was perfectly all right. And I walked in that hospital. I went to this fellow's room and told him they needed a drink and could I borrow some liquor. And, of course, I knew the drawer was full. But I looked around, and he didn't have anything to put it in, you know. And I hadn't taken my pocketbook, and they weren't big enough then to hold anything anyhow. So I didn't know how I was going to get it to the car. At least I must have been sober enough to know not to walk down the hall with it in my hand with nothing over it. So I remember taking the man's bedpan out of the bedside table. That was back when they had those old tin, enamel, white enamel, with paper sack covers over them. And I remember I told him, he said, take what you want. And I took a fifth. It was brand new. It hadn't been opened, but it wasn't even in a sack. So I took that bedpan out, and I took that fifth of liquor. I laid it down that bedpan, and I put that paper over it, and here I am, drunk, in the middle of the night, walking down the hospital hall, out the back door, with a bedpan. I said, I had been slinging bedpans long enough to know nobody was going to stop me and ask me what I had in it, because they never had. But I told that story in Savannah one night in an AA meeting, and when I got through, a fella came up to me, and if anybody ever calls me Dorothy Carolyn, I knew that was somebody that knew me a long time ago. He came up and put his arm around me, and he said, Dorothy Carolyn, do you want to know what you did with that bedpan? And I said, hell no, I don't want to know what I did with the bedpan. He was with me that night. I did that. And I didn't want to hear nothing about it, and I wanted him to know I didn't want to hear nothing about it. I was sorry he was there. It just embarrassed me to run into people that I spent my drunk days with. It really did. I didn't like what I did when I was drunk. And I tell you the truth, I didn't like a lot of what I did when I got sober either. It was rough for me. After being there 6 years, I met the man that I married, and that was a crazy love affair, courtship. And it was crazy for 12 years after our marriage with the drinking. I know now that we were both alcoholic when we met. He was freshly divorced. I had never been married. I was funny about marriage. It was serious to me. It was sacred. It was a commitment. I have always felt that way about marriage, and I still do. And I knew I needed to be careful about getting married because I didn't want to make a mistake. I have always been funny about making mistakes because I just never wanted to make one. I never wanted anybody to know I made one. If I made one, I wasn't about to admit it. And I knew it would be that way. If I married and made a mistake, I'd probably stay in it rather than admit it. I'd made a mistake. And I was serious about it. But I fell in love and I was drunk. In love and married 12 years before I realized what had happened to me and had 3 children and was about to have another one. But it was meant to be, I think. He knew right away that he had a problem, and because he was forced to because of physical problems that began to show up with the alcoholism and addiction. I did not have to admit that I had a problem at that time, except that him. I knew he was my problem. And I feel like any alcoholic ought to have some spouse to blame it on. I mean, I think they're handicapped if they don't. I really do think it is a real terrible thing for an alcoholic not to be married and have somebody to blame it on. I just think it real handy. And I used it. I used it an awful lot because I honestly believed that he was my problem. And I felt like all he needed when I married him was a good wife, because he was fresh divorced, and she was not the wife for him, I felt sure, because he told me that it was a mistake. And so I set out to straighten him out, and I was a full-blown alcoholic at that time. I know now I was, but it was like a pregnancy. You know, it takes a while for it to show. I was the alcoholic. I know now I was, but it just was not to the showing stage. And I kept mine pretty well covered. I was one of those that talked to him about his drinking, but I never mentioned mine, and he never mentioned mine. And he said later he didn't know I drank too much. And that I believe. Because I would ask him, how did I act? And he'd say, you acted fine, honey. You didn't do anything out of the way. I never had anybody fuss at me about my drinking. I never had anybody to hide my liquor from me. I never had anybody to tell me that I had a problem with drinking or drugs. But I know it was there, and we knew it, because we took drugs together and we drank together. We were drinking partners. And back then, there was no such thing that I know of social doping. It is now. But ours was not social. It was pretty private. And you better believe we didn't let anybody know it. And it got real bad. The drugs and the alcohol got so bad, and he was in treatment in one place and another, being treated for nervous disorders. And he was never diagnosed, even when it was very obvious. But back then, this has been a long time ago. I've neglected to say, and I will probably say later, but I've been sober. This next November, if I make it, it'll be 28 years. So I'm in my 27th year. And there wasn't any knowledge and information. I'm sure the people that lived with it knew a lot about these things, but back then it was a time when you didn't have the information and all that we have now. It was, alcoholism was a disgrace, and dope fiend was disgrace, and all these things that now are maybe acceptable was not acceptable at that time. So we were real private. We became real private. We hid everything. When he went off for treatment, we'd put a notice in the paper that he'd gone off to school for a certain length of time. We advertised that. And, of course, I stayed home and took care of things. I was the responsible person. And I thought. And eventually, he did get in treatment where he could not leave. And that is when he found Alcoholics Anonymous in Lexington, Kentucky. And while he was there, I had a hard time, because, you see, I had had nervous breakdowns. You know, a lady alcoholic, it was pretty popular and sociable, acceptable back then to have nervous breakdowns. So I had nervous breakdowns. I had one after another. And finally, I got to where I finally went to a psychiatrist. But I went to tell the psychiatrist about my husband that was causing me to have the nervous breakdowns. Seems to me that he did ask me one time if I drank, and seems to me I told him, well, I would take an occasional drink with my husband. I'm not sure about that, but I'm sure that's what I thought I would have told him if he had asked me. So, and I would have believed it. I don't know. Every now and then I find myself, you know, with on a 12-step call or something, thinking, well, why in the hell can't they? Ain't no reason why they can't see they got a problem. And I try to think about these things. That part of the illness is that we just don't know it. It's the denial, and all that's a symptom of the illness. That's the kind of illness we've got. We've got the kind of illness that tells us we ain't got it. Real strong. No matter what you say or what you feel, how bad you hurt, how bad your head hurts, it's going to tell you you ain't got it. And I used to sit on the side of the bed every morning and say, I wonder if the drinking's got anything to do with it. I'm not going to drink tonight, and I'm going to see. And by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm drinking. You know? It's crazy. And that's part of the illness. And I know that, and yet I still have that tendency. And so I went to the doctors, and finally now let me show you the way I operated. I went to the psychiatrist one day. I had been going for years. He gave me a different pill every time I went. They never took any of them away from me. They gave me a new one each time because the last one wasn't working. And I didn't need theirs in the first place. I had plenty. It just made it more legitimate somehow if I got out of the house to get it. I don't know. And, you know, my mother told me one time, said, Dot, you take too many pills. I said, well, you've always been so damn smart, you know more than the doctors anyhow. You know. So I just had that attitude. And anyway, I went to the psychiatrist, and I went to him and told him if he didn't do something for me. Now, I'm threatening the psychiatrist. If you don't do something for me, I'm going to kill myself. And that's the way I did everybody. I threatened other people with my business. I'd put the responsibility on them. And I had done that all my life, but I didn't know it. I'd do that with my husband. See what you've done to me. You know, look what you've done to me and these children. You know. And I remember that was the day he put me in the hospital and started me on electric shock treatments. They were kind of in then. You remember that. And they don't do that now for alcoholism. It never was the right thing to do for alcoholism. But I'll tell you what it did. It kept me alive until I found you people. And I'm grateful for it. I do not resent it. Whatever happened to me kept me alive until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. But I love those shock treatments, and I'd hear people talk. I never heard anybody talk about it. They'd ever had a shock treatment until I got to A. And I didn't tell anybody for a long time because I didn't think it was a very nice thing to talk about. But when I did talk about it, I heard other people say how horrible they were. And they didn't, they were just horrible. And I loved them, so I knew I was a little strange. And I hated to tell them how much I liked them. So I sat around a while, and I thought, well, you know, I don't know why I'm different. Because I actually got addicted to the shock treatments, and I got one every chance I got. If I felt a nervous coming on, I'd take off. I'd get in my car and head out. And I know now what I got addicted to that I found out those other people didn't get, because they, most of them was in the insane asylums. And they didn't do theirs. They just hooked up those wires and went, they didn't give them anything. They just hooked them up, you know. But mine, I got the sodium pentothal first. So I was addicted to the sodium pentothal. It was the only relief I had. And God, I'd have taken them every hour if they'd have given them to me. Just put that sodium pentothal in my vein, I'm out like a light. Total oblivion. I didn't care about anything. That was what I had been wanting all the time. Just stop this mind. I never wanted to be drunk in my life. We got a man at home that says a drunk man's bad, but a drunk woman is something else. And I feel the same way. It is totally against my principles to be drunk. And I never wanted to be drunk. I just wanted to stop this mind. And the sodium pentothal came near doing it than anything else. So I took them for years. I've never been back to know how many I had. It isn't necessary. But when my husband got back from Lexington, I think I got my last shock treatment about that time. I was still drinking, but I was just drinking beer because I found out I'd get drunk. And I had to look after those children. I had to be responsible. God knows I had to be responsible. That nearly killed me. I said, if I ever go back to drinking, I'm going to Skid Row. I ain't going to no PTA. I ain't going to no church circle. I ain't going to nothing. I'm going out there, and I'm going to the ditches or going to the streets somewhere where nobody expects me to be responsible, because what damn near killed me was trying to be responsible. And I can't do that again. Had to be responsible. When he came home, he had found Alcoholics Anonymous in the hospital, and I went to my first AA meeting with him, and I made sure everybody knew that he was the alcoholic, and I was going to join Al-Anon. I loved Al-Anon. I could identify with everything that they said, and I truly am so grateful to Al-Anon, because I kept going until we could get an Al-Anon group started at home. And then I started hearing some things in AA, and I started identifying with the alcoholics. I didn't want to. I didn't want to at all. But I started identifying with them. And then there was a man, and he's one of these old-timers. You know, Jim, they can say some of the damnedest things, you know, and you just won't kill them. But I heard it. And it was our friend Virgil. And I think he was saying it just for me, because he knew me pretty good. And it was one Sunday afternoon. And he said, if you're dependent on another human being for your happiness, you are going to be sadly disappointed. And I'm sitting there totally dependent on my husband for my happiness. Totally. Financially, emotionally, everything. And the reason I wanted to die and kept hoping and praying I'd die was because I knew my husband was going to die, and I knew I could not survive without him. That is a terrible feeling. So I wanted and prayed desperately to die every day so I wouldn't have to do that. I knew he was going to die. And then the next Sunday I went to another meeting to help my husband. And some man sitting back there got up and just, he wasn't even the speaker, I don't think. He just got up and made some smart remark, like they'll do. And he said, if you're sitting back there taking pills, you'd be better off to go to your liquor. And of course, I hadn't had a drink since my husband got home, because I didn't want him to drink. But I was taking me a pill to get up in the morning. I was taking one before meals, after meals, between meals, bedtime, and some during meetings. And when that man said that, it clicked. And I went home. I didn't know anything about all this stuff. I didn't know about convulsions. I didn't know about DTs. I didn't know about all this withdrawal stuff. Nobody else knew about it then either. They just died back then. And I went home and threw all my pills. See, I was attracted to what you all had by then. It didn't matter, Al-Anon or AA. I didn't care by then. This is a program of attraction. I hope we always remember that. Because I wasn't attracted to any program. I wasn't attracted to any big book. I wasn't attracted to any 12 steps. I was attracted to the fellowship, the love, the people. And I hung around until I wanted it so bad I got willing to go to any length to get it when I didn't even know what a program was. And I wanted it so bad. Now, you know I wanted it and I was attracted to it if I went home and flushed all my pills down the toilet at one time. If I had known what I know now, I wouldn't have done that. That wasn't a very smart thing to do. But I did it. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't even know. We hadn't even talked about me and my alcoholism or anything at that time. It was totally secret. We didn't talk about things like that. I talked about his. And so that was the beginning of my rough days. I did okay in AA until I threw my pills away. And that's when the bitching started. I didn't have anything to calm my nerves. I was one nervous wreck. I didn't go back to the psychiatrist anymore. You know, since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had a drink of alcohol. I threw away my mood-changing drugs, and I have not been back to a psychiatrist. I needed some a long time, all of them. But I just hung in this program. They kept telling me this too will pass. You know, one day at a time. It'll get better. All this stuff, these slogans that people don't see any sense in, God knows I just lived by them until I could get into the steps. They're valuable. Don't ever underestimate the value of these slogans on the wall that look so stupid and silly. Because they helped me survive until I could get deeper into the program. I wanted what you had so bad, I'd have killed for it, I believe. I hear C.D. talk about, I'd have killed somebody for a drink. I wanted what you all had so bad. You know, I had cried and looked sad so long and frowned. And when I started going to AA, we would load up a car and head out and be gone sometimes a whole weekend. I wouldn't even know where we'd been. It didn't matter. And everybody'd tell jokes and laugh. And my face hurt because it takes different muscles to laugh than it does to frown. And I loved it. One of the things, we had a man with us one time, and we were in a restaurant, and he was an Al-Anon. He wasn't even an alcoholic. But it was so funny. The lady came by and asked him, what he'd have for dessert? And God, I hadn't laughed in so long. And it said, assorted pies. And he said, I think I'll take the assorted pies. And I thought I would die. I mean, it was so funny. Everything was funny with those people. I hope we don't forget that. It's a program of attraction. The big book tells us that. And they really attracted me. And I'm so glad they left me alone till I got well enough to get a program. I was so sick. Nobody will ever know. I was unhappy with everything. There was nothing in my life I was happy about. And most of all, at that time, I was not happy about my husband. Now, all these years, I had told him if he would just get sober, everything would be all right. And now he is sober, and I am madder than I have ever been in my life. I mean, and especially I hated him, because I could no longer blame him for what happened. He wouldn't take it. And that made me madder. And the next thing, I'm pregnant, and I ain't even sure I want to be married. I'm pretty sure I don't. And I had my AA baby. I was sober 1 year. Not quite a year. 10 months when I had my AA baby, my girl that I'd always wanted after having three boys. At this time, I had three boys. They were 11, 9 1/2, and 6. And now here I am figuring how I'm going to get rid of this husband. And I'm pregnant. That's a hell of a shape to be in. But it was okay. By that time, I had no choice. I couldn't leave. That was about the time, pretty soon after that, that I started saving, got me a little savings account. So when I decided to leave, I'd have something to leave on. Because the only reason I hadn't already left, I didn't have anything to leave on. Nowhere to go. And I was going to do something about that. And I know that if we were able to make our marriage work, I swear I believe just about anybody could if they were willing. It was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. The not drinking was not the big problem. It was the adjusting to living in reality. And making the adjustments. We got married. We were both alcoholic. We didn't even know each other. I mean, it would have been a lot easier just to marry somebody new and start over. Because I don't think he liked me any more than I liked him. And I won't ever forget it. Poor thing, I really gave him hell. And I eventually tried to make up and think I did for that because, you know, they talk a lot about physical abuse, but they don't talk a lot about verbal abuse. And he was a kind man and a man of few words, and he just wasn't the kind I was. He grew up in a home where he said he had never heard his mother and daddy have a cross word. And I grew up in a home that my mama bitched all the time. She knew no other way to talk, and it was just natural. And we had to adjust that and work it out, and it was hard. But we were able to do it through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't ever forget one day I walked in. He walked in, and I was sitting there waiting for him, as I usually did, to tell him how sick the children were, how bad they'd been all day, and how sick I was, and how much their fever was, and how much fever I had, and all that, because I wanted him to do something about it. He was a doctor, and I expected him to do something about it. And if he loved us, he would do something about it. And he'd already learned better than to fool with me. You know, he got some sense while he was in treatment, and I didn't have any. But I won't ever forget that day he walked in, and I was reading the big book today, and it told my story in there about the way the man took on his responsibilities and he took his rightful place in his home when he got sober. And I got after him that day and followed him into the living room, and he sat down to rest after a day's work, was going to read the paper, and I didn't like that. And I went in with that finger like women do, you know. We just, you know, glad it's not loaded. And I gave him that, and I'll never forget, he laid that paper down on his lap, and I knew it took a lot for him to say what he was about to say. And he just very calmly said, "If you open your mouth one more time, I'm going to leave, and I'm not coming back." Now, you see, I had been threatening to divorce him. I was so scared he was going to leave. I almost taped my mouth shut because I knew I couldn't keep from saying something. I was so scared, I didn't say anything either. You better believe I didn't. And then one night, my resentments got so bad. A lot of people hear me talk about my 10 years of struggling, and they don't like to hear it, but that was what recovery was for me, and the big book speaks of that as we trudge the way to happy destiny. It doesn't say as we skip along the way to happy destiny. We trudge, and I trudged, and I trudged, and I trudged, and he was happy. And after all the harm and damage he had done us, he's happy as a doodle and lies down every night and goes to sleep just like he ain't got no sense at all. And the more he slept, the madder I got. And one night, he snored one time too many, and I was just stood it long as I could. And I just reached over and knocked the holy hell out of him. And I'll never forget it. He sat up and said, "What do you want?" Well, I hadn't thought about what I wanted. Neither did I know what I wanted. And all I could think of at the time was I want a divorce. I mean, you know. And he said, "For what?" Well, I hadn't thought about for what. And all I could think of is at the time, I started to say for sleeping, but I'd already told him if he'd lie down and sleep like he ought to, everything would be all right, you know. So I did have sense enough to think of that. And then all I could think of was, "Because you don't love me. You never have loved me. You never have loved the children." And he was a pretty smart man. I'll never know whether he meant it or whether he'd been taught somewhere along the way to say something like that in an emergency. I'll never know. It doesn't matter. But he said, honey, I love you more than I've ever loved anybody in my life. I'm happier. You might use this if you ever need it. It worked. He said, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And if you've got to have a divorce, there is nothing I can do to stop you. But I want you to know right now, I'll have no part of it. He turned over and went back to sleep. I turned over and went to sleep. Now, this shows me my insecurity, see. Once I knew he loved me, I haven't had a problem with that since. You know, that was all I needed to know because I was really afraid that he was waiting for me to get well enough and he was going to leave me. He was just too much of a gentleman to leave me with me that sick. And I never had a problem with that anymore because that was his out. He could have taken that if I asked for it, and he refused it. So from then on, I went up. That wasn't the end of it. But that was some of the turning points in my life. And after 10 years sobriety, I fought it to the bitter end. I knew nothing about anything but fighting for what I wanted. I had been taught that if you had enough willpower, you could do it. And by God, if you're out there fighting, trying to get what you want, you better turn it loose and let it go. And after 10 years, something happened. And I was getting critical of people who were having slips. And I was being judgmental. And in the middle of the night, one night, I realized, I've got to change or I'm going to go back to drinking and taking drugs. Because I knew I couldn't feel this way any longer and not take something and not do something. Because I'd done it one day at the time. I had done all that. It was going to get me better. But now I knew I was at a turning point. And I had never been honest with my husband about my feelings. We had absolutely no communication. I thought it was him, but now looking back, I feel like probably he was being more honest with me than I was with him. And that was, we were working and all, and it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He was still up working. And I'll never forget, I went in his office, and it's the first time in my life I had ever been honest to God, truly honest with him. We were going to Blackstone, and he had started flying an airplane, and he thought I resented his flying, but what I resented was the time that it took away that we had together. We took a day, an extra day riding to Blackstone, and we'd spend the night on the road and go on in. That gave us 2 days going and 2 days coming back. And that was my time twice a year with him, and that was the, you know, that was it. That was real special to me. And we were about to go to Blackstone. He wanted me to go, and I wasn't going. And I know that was because we were flying. And I didn't want to go because I didn't have time. You don't fly and all that engine going. You don't hear nothing. You can't talk. He's just flying that damn airplane. And me sitting there madder than hell, and I didn't want to go that way. So I went in that night, and I was crying like a baby. And that was the night I surrendered. And I said, honey, what I really need is some time with you. And you know what he said? He said, well, why didn't you say so? He was the happiest I'd ever seen him to know that what I needed was some time with him. I had never told him that before. And from then on, it was up road. We began to talk. We got into a lot of things in communication. We learned to talk to each other about reality and what was going on and how we felt. And I learned not to fight when I'm mad. I don't talk about things when I'm mad. I wait until I'm able to talk. I can say I'm too mad to talk right now. I'll talk about it later. I did all that. We worked through it. We were married 12 years when we got sober, and we had 24 sober years before I had to let him go. Now, this husband that I could not live without, by the time I had to let him go, by the grace of God and the AA program, I was able to do that. It wasn't easy. He was sick a long time. I went through a lot. I was really sick when he died. But his death, instead of being something that I dreaded it, but the whole thing was spiritual. There was a lot that happened during that time that he was able to see this AA baby that we had go through her alcoholism. And we went down the road with that. I learned a lot about living with the alcoholic. And I learned a lot about release with love that I thought I knew that I didn't know. I know how it is to have a child call you from way off somewhere and be in a world of trouble and near death and having to say, I'm sorry, I can't do anything about it. You'll have to call somebody in AA or the police there. I remember the night that I became willing. And I know something about willingness. By being willing to do some things, I haven't had to do them. But I remember the night that I became entirely willing to let her die if that was what was necessary, knowing I was totally powerless over it. But I didn't have to let her die. By releasing her with love and giving her the freedom to do whatever she had to do to get ready and die if that was necessary, she became ready and came into AA voluntarily, and now she's near 5 years sobriety. And Dr. John was able to live to see that. God gave him 2 extra years to see that and to see a little grandchild, a son that she had, that's as much like him as anything I've ever seen in my life. He was able to live to see our middle boy get a divorce after about 10 or 11 years of marriage, exactly like he did. He was married 10 years before his divorce. And he was able to talk to that son, and they identified with each other on a lot of things, and that was a big help. The baby boy is sober, I think, about 10 years in AA now. We were able to live through that. Our oldest son is a member of Al-Anon and always has been a member of Al-Anon, and he's working his program. 2 of the boys' wives are in the program, and one of them was responsible for the middle boy coming into AA. And we are an AA family. And you know, I can't think of anything that I'd rather have my children be than a part of the AA program or Al-Anon program. And we are a family. We talk, we communicate, we say what we feel, we try to do it appropriately. Sometimes we don't, but we do it. And I tell you the truth, just to get off to a place like this with people like you to celebrate my sobriety is one of the greatest experiences. And Lucille and I have had a good time today talking because we were drinking partners. And we haven't been together a lot since we've been sober. But the love was still there. There is nothing better than having a drinking buddy come in AA. God, it's like the prodigal son coming home, I think. You know, it's the most exciting thing, and you want to celebrate it. It's just the greatest thing I know of. And you know, that God that I was so afraid of, I know that had a lot to do with me not being willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. But you know, in AA, you didn't tell me about what God was going to do to me. You told me what God was going to do for me. And when you talked about the good things that had happened in your life, you told me you gave God credit for it. And I'd heard God work through people, and I saw it. I could believe what I saw. God works through people, and you told me about God, and you told me about a loving God. And I learned about a God of love, understanding, compassion, and forgiveness that I'd never known before. That took a long time, but once I got that, I had no problem taking that third step, which is made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And I know that my life and my happiness depends on my relationship with my higher power. If I can stay tuned with God's will, I'll be a happy person. I am a happy person. I had a hard time adjusting to living alone after 36 years marriage. I was afraid of what I would do. I really see a lot of women go crazy, and I was so scared I'd go crazy. But I didn't. I gave myself a year. I said, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to make any decisions. I'm not going to have any relationships. I'm not going to do anything for a year. And then I think I can have the freedom to do something or not do something if I still got some sense. I ain't had much, but I've had enough. And I've gotten through this thing. It was hard. I couldn't go some of the places we used to go. I had feelings tonight being in here, but it passed right off. I've been able to get out and find that I still have feelings. I can have a good time. I can be happy. And that's what He would want. I went through a lot of grief. I went through a lot of anger because we had a lot of things we'd planned to do, and at times I'd forget about all the things we had done. We had a good marriage. We had a good life. We had a good relationship. We had as good a marriage as anybody could ever have. And it came out of something that looked absolutely, totally hopeless in the beginning. God's been good to me and my children and my family, and it's every bit come through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding that has... I'm so scared I'm going to get involved in something that ain't God's will. I find myself, I used to beg God for what I wanted. I'd say, God, if you just please give it to me. You know, I'll do anything. And I find myself begging, God, please don't let me have it if it ain't your will. Please don't let me have it. Make something stop me. You know, that's the difference. And I feel like that's why I'm happy, is because I do. God is my director. And I hope I never forget that. I appreciate you asking me. I'm glad to be here, and I love you all because you are my family. Thank you.